after coming to Penn and starting to work with Dan Hunt, who was a professor here, having come from Harvard, where he developed the lung on a chip, I really was blown away by this ability to see human tissue growing in a piece of plastic in front of me. And these two worlds of extremely complex biology and extremely high throughput experimentation in microfluidics came together so elegantly, and the ability to take those complex tissues and to scale them with the power of high throughput microfluidics.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Welcome back. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS. Today's episode features a pioneering company that is revolutionizing how we study human biology and develop new drugs. Vivodyne has developed a groundbreaking microfluidic bioengineering platform capable of growing tens of thousands of human tissue samples at scale. By automating the precise control of cellular environments in miniaturized Hive instruments, Vivodyne avoids variability from human interaction to gather massive amounts of high-quality human data before clinical trials. Our guest is Andre Georgescu, the CEO of Vivodyne. Andre's unique background bridging electrical engineering and bioengineering led him to develop this innovative approach. Instead of top-down engineering, Vivodyne employs bottoms-up self-assembly principles to grow complex tissues that better mimic human physiology. Hosting the interview is Yin He, Principal Business Development for Healthcare and Life Sciences Startups at AWS. Yin will explore how Vivodyne's platform combines the principles of organs on chips and organoids at high throughput. This enables studying tissue interactions, systemic effects like immune responses, and linking multiple tissue systems as Lego blocks to model integrated human biology. Vivodyne is producing foundational data currently lacking on gene edits, drug metabolism, off-target effects, and more to improve drug development success rates. This was a great interview and insightful discussion on how Vivodyne is displacing animal testing and leveraging AI to transform our understanding of human health. Over to you, Yin and Andre.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. I'm excited to guest host this session today. My name is Yin He, and I lead our work with early-stage healthcare life sciences startups and investors at AWS. I'm trained as a wet lab scientist with a PhD in molecular biology and genomics. Prior to AWS, I was an early employee and operator at a venture-backed startup building cloud labs and software tools to help pharma and biotechs accelerate drug discovery. For this reason, I'm so excited to be joined today by Andre Georgescu, CEO and co-founder of Vivodyne. Andre, welcome. Let's dig in. I'm so looking forward to learning more about your founder journey and how the company came to be.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Wonderful. To get us started, can you just tell us a little bit about the company and what you all do?
Sure. So Vivodyne's fundamental mission is to gather human data before clinical trials and to gather that data at massive scale so that we can answer the very difficult questions about biology and how, you know, our own bodies work with the requisite scale of data that is needed to answer that kind of set of fundamental questions. It's a large set, so we need a lot of data.
That's wonderful. And to step back and take a peek at your founder journey, can you tell us about your background and what led you to where we are today and to build this company?
Sure. I actually started off as an electrical engineer very briefly with this kind of obsession of taking very simple but functional pieces of almost like puzzle pieces that each do something and aggregated them into a much more complex and functional whole, right? So that is almost what a microprocessor or integrated circuit does. And I stumbled onto biology very briefly in undergrad. And it was like, I had always thought biologists just look through a microscope and stare at cells all day and wrote it off a little bit and was obsessed with the ability for us to build tools and to do things. But I realized very quickly in that small brush that like the extent of engineering and our know-how as people compared to what biology possesses, you feel like you're banging sticks and stones together in comparison. And so I very quickly switched to bioengineering with the hopes of learning what the kind of amazing engineering tools biology has built and how to take those tools and employ them for technology that we want to develop as people. Let's say if we had a alien spacecraft like crash land in a field, we would all be hurrying to figure out how all the different pieces worked so we could build something even more profound with them. And so started leading into biology, And the kind of close equivalent of microprocessors in biology was building microfluidics where we could perform like many experiments in parallel. And I began working with biosensing at the very beginning, with looking for pathogens in drinking water and looking for a very rare strand of RNA in liquid, for example. And after coming to Penn and starting to work with Dan Hunt, who was a professor here, having come from Harvard, where he developed the lung on a chip, I really was blown away by this ability to see human tissue growing in a piece of plastic in front of me. And these two worlds of extremely complex biology and extremely high throughput experimentation in microfluidics came together so elegantly, and the ability to take those complex tissues and to scale them with the power of high throughput microfluidics.
Yeah, I'm curious, as an engineer, like your first foray into biology, what struck you the most as, oh my gosh, we're still in the dark ages. There's just so much, you know, potential to transform how we do things and sciences and where we can learn and pull in lessons from other disciplines.
The thing that struck me the most when I was a kid and getting my bearings in engineering, the things that fascinated me most were like the simple mechanisms behind, I remember like my VCR trying to figure out the linkage of a VHS cassette going in and being loaded into the VCR itself, and like being mesmerized by the little, whatever, 3-4 bar little linkages that are moving the thing inside. And then, so I developed this kind of fascination with mechanisms to make things move, and then got into biology, and you see this incredible stack up of far more sophisticated mechanisms, right? There are, the most common example is the hydrogen like turbine on mitochondria that generates power from the gradient of protons. But also things like that 70% of the genome that we all thought was remnants of viral infections and stuff and our ancestors and so on, becoming this really critical region for pulling DNA together and exposing a read site or exposing a promoter for something, or just the cycling of proteins through cells, the way that they tag certain vesicles to send them to different locations. Like all of these things really spoke to me as an engineer, and they spoke to me in this, all right, like what we're doing as people is trivial in comparison, right? Especially at the scale that a cell does them. And this is, I think, anyone probably listening, but this seems like a trivial, oh, wow, I was blown away by biology. But it was, to me, it just felt so profound, because I was like, we have the sophistication right here in front of us. It just became, I don't know, so obvious in my own head that there was so much that we could leverage within that depth.
Yeah. I think what's so impressive about biology is just you can keep digging. If you take it from an engineering perspective, how do you break down a lot of complexity into sort of simple building blocks? And I think what's always shocking is just even for a simple building block, there's additional building blocks that continue to form that. Just the overall complexity of it and what feels like an infinite search space, right? As you're trying to tackle problems.
Yep. And I think there's like this, what is the hardest thing about biology in my mind is, especially with a lot of the recent instrumentation that's been developed in cryo-electron microscopy and in single cell sequencing and a lot of these like huge advances, we've been able to go very deep down the rabbit holes. So if I'm wondering what this exonic sequence in the DNA actually does, I can find the protein produced by that sequence and I can isolate it and I can image it in cryo-EM and understand the structure, and I can look at where it's expressed in certain cells, and I can really dig deep on that one protein. But the integrative knowledge that we have about biology that says, if I make a small change to this protein, how does that propagate to every other rabbit hole that we have dug, is like surprisingly sparse. So when we are developing drugs, we're hitting a single target, and that is because we know what that target does. And what we try to then spend the rest of the drug development cycle trying to figure out is, what else does it do, right? How does it affect everything else around it? Yeah, it's an exciting feeling to feel like you're at the frontier of trying to figure that part out, which is where my own kind of deep interest is. Like, how can we connect all these rabbit holes together?
Yeah, and create better model systems in biology. I think a lot of these things are one-off, and the processes to get to certain outcomes is very bespoke and custom. And so now I think with the advent of just huge amounts of data with AI ML, we'll dive into this a little bit later, but even generating new types of data on how to use all of that in a very systematic way so that we can generate better models in this space. All right, I want to go back to lab on a chip, because this is just an area that is just so fascinating. I feel like there's just so much new developments that are coming out of it. For people who aren't familiar, can you tell us a little bit more about how the technology for lab on a chip evolved? And what specifically, when you think about organ on a chip, right, which correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the most recent evolution, right, or rendition of this technology. What does it enable us to do that we couldn't do before?
Totally. So the kind of fundamental concept of lab on a chip through microfluidics. And this is still a bit away from the biology side, but like, what does it fundamentally do and why do it? If we think of a mechanical engineering process, like building a car, you have these massive warehouses and the cars are big and you can put them through all these different stations and have different operations executed on those cars. In chemistry, each part of that car is very small. And so you do not need to create, you know, massive volumes. And I say massive, like milliliter scale volumes are pretty massive compared to the size of one, you know, molecule. You don't need to create volumes that large to perform some experiment in chemistry or perform some process. And usually the difficulties in working with very large batch sizes are a kind of loss of control of what is happening on the small scale. And so you get irregularities in the mixing of a mixing tank, or you get temperature gradients in some process chamber or what have you. And if you can miniaturize that and integrate an entire assembly line onto a microfluidic device, you are still working with volumes that are, you know, again, relative to the molecule, quite large. And so you can make, let's say, hundreds or thousands or billions of those molecules and still be in this very small millimeter scale or micron scale or even smaller form factor. But you get a huge amount of control over those reactions because fluids tend to behave much more predictably at very small scales, right? You have these viscous forces that dominate and there's no turbulence, right? Both in a figurative sense, like no chaotic behavior, but also in a physical sense, everything flows where you expect it to and so forth. And so in a lot of chemical processing, there's huge advantages to be gained from working at those scales in consistency and in like even the ability to monitor and understand what's happening in a process. But the difficulty is in taking like interfacing that microfluidic system or that lab on a chip to the rest of the world or the rest of the lab, right? So like the chip to world interface often ends up being a bottleneck and becomes the thing that prevents us from really being this manufacturing plant type of system. You need scientists or technicians to sit and work with the thing. Now with biology, one of the big kind of benefits that carry over to trying to grow, starting with single cells and all the way to much more complex, like physiological scale systems in this microfluidics, is all those benefits of control that labs on a chip offer, you can carry right over. And you have control over the gradients of different chemicals and growth factors that are kind of presented to these cells and these tissues. You have control over gradients of even cells that you're inserting into these devices. You can sample from very small volumes and you don't need like entire humans worth of cells to perform an experiment, especially if the behaviors and the kind of kinetics and dynamics of that system operate on a small enough scale, let's say across a few hundred thousand cells, they can scale them down. And so really the benefit is you can control very carefully the interface between the engineering part of a system and the biology part and ensure a great degree of consistency to that.
Yeah, it sounds like you're removing a lot of variables, right? Which is oftentimes just regardless of how you do biology experiments, they creep in, even in terms of reagents, right? Quality, the free thaw cycles, just the reproducibility is so hard to maintain in science, so that at the end of the day, it's hard to know what to attribute an effect back to.
Yeah, one of the things that biology has developed really well is we have all sorts of feedback loops that lead to the emergent complexity that is biology. But biology has found very many ways to like tame that variability. And if things are going a little bit off the road, like you have systems that are agonists to that and can reel it back in. And so during development, that is happening, right? You have all sorts of controls during human development, even during day-to-day cycles in our bodies that control one thing for another. You take a endocrine supplement and a certain part of your body stops making that hormone, or One of the kind of key challenges to trying to miniaturize parts of biology is that oftentimes you are losing some of that kind of peripheral control, and you need to like affect that control over what you're trying to grow. And so the precision of small scale microfluidics allows you to exert that control really precisely and to guide the kind of consistent development of biology within these systems. So it's like a great pairing of a tool meant to do something really well and something that needs that thing to be done really well to be useful.
Yeah, it's like applying those engineering principles to biology to create these tools. Let's spend a little bit more time. I don't feel like we gave it enough air time, but the company has such a cool technology platform. I want to spend some time and just have you tell us what is the core technology capability of Vividyne.
Sure. So we talk a lot about microfluidics and a bit about biology. The fundamental mission of our company is to produce huge quantities of human data without actually needing to go to clinical trials and gather that data from like actual people. And this, like the desire to want to have data before clinical trials is not a novel one. It's the reason why we do animal tests, the reason why we have many assays with cell lines and petri dishes. But there are really drastic shortcomings to the quality of the data that results from either of those. From very simple studies with cells growing in a petri dish, we are cutting out so much of the complexity of biology, and we are reducing it to just one very homogenous kind of layer of cells growing flat on plastic. And the interactions between that cell type and everything else by which it would be surrounded in the human body suddenly gets cut out. And so if we have a drug, for example, that stops the growth of new blood vessels into a tumor, and we are looking at how that drug affects the cells that make blood vessels but growing flat on a dish, like we might not see that outcome or that interaction in such a simple system. And by cutting out this huge, I'd say majority kind of subset of complex interactions and dynamics in the body, we are not able to map the results we get in our early studies to what happens in people in clinical trials. And especially if we're cutting out the interactions at which like disease actually manifests, right? So we move to animals, which are far more complex. They're as complex as we are. Like a mouse is definitely smaller than a person, but all of its complexity and our complexity is still there. It has all the same organ systems. It has many of the same hormones and signaling and all that. There's a lot that is conserved. But the really tricky part with animals is a mouse and a person, to use like a machine learning analogy, they're almost like two fine-tuned models of a common like mammalian development kind of base. And
of an ancestor, right?
Yeah. And so what's so hard to know is it's like if I have a image generation tool and it is fine-tuned on pictures of architecture and I find a perfect prompt that'll get me some cathedral in the middle of Philadelphia if I want to. If I take a different model and I give it the same prompt, I cannot easily predict what differences there will be in that output image before actually trying it. And so by that same analogy in clinical studies, we are testing on animals and hoping that the result is quite similar when we get to people, but the result is often not. And so what we do as a company is we instead grow human tissues at large scale before ever getting to those clinical trials so that we have some of that human data before testing on people, which is this wildly expensive experiment, right? Probably the most expensive experiment there is. And we aim to gather that data, that human data before clinical trials at massive scale and with massive reproducibility without any sacrifice to the realism of the physiology that is happening in there. So the way that we do that is we grow tens of thousands of these human tissues at scale using microfluidics and benefiting from all those abilities to exert control on those tissues. And we then have all of that live within this big automated instrument that we call a hive that for weeks on end will perform that microfluidics to lab interface that otherwise requires like huge armies of people to perform. And in so doing, a very key thing that we avoid is the variability of human interaction with these samples. All of this is to gather sufficient data to develop ultimately what we hope is a like foundational understanding and foundational model of how human physiology works in an integrative sense. So if we can perform, for example, gene deletions or gene insertions or like activations of certain genes that are transient, and we look at the effects of those changes on the phenotype and the function of whole tissues, we can learn much more deeply the effect of one little thing on everything around it than we currently can in mice, which are limited in throughput, or on people, which we obviously cannot gene edit. The other really substantial benefit is, I think, in discovering and developing new drugs, the biggest bottleneck to having conviction in that thing before it reaches clinical trials and is subject to a 94% failure rate is that the data that is gathered leading into it has to be subsetted at some point in the process. So we have a whiteboard full of all sorts of different risk factors and scientific steps that are happening with that drug. It is binding to this thing, it's activating this portion of that pathway, then it's being metabolized into this other compound and affecting these other things. And you have to pick and choose in a animal study which one or two, maybe three of those factors you want to test. And the rest of them, you just have to hope that they're not going to cause trouble.
And what do we see most of the time? It doesn't work out, right?
Yeah. So. You have the world's smartest biologists trying to solve these problems. And even there, facing a 94% failure rate, and it is not a question of like the people are not doing it well enough. It is like they are doing what they can with the data that is insufficient. And so that is the kind of critical thing that we are addressing. It is producing human data, especially at a scale that can benefit AI, because the data just doesn't exist currently.
Yeah, it's incredible. I know what you all do, but every time I hear it, it's just, I just feel like it's so groundbreaking, right? We talk about technology and innovations that are incremental versus, you know, being truly disruptive. And I think guys clearly fall in the latter, right?
If you can figure
this out, I think this will truly transform how we think about the later stages of drug discovery through clinicals. I know this organ on a chip helps us elevate beyond this single cell, right, model. How do you approach things like organ interactions or systemic reactions that can happen from a drug and that typically you see in a clinical human clinical trial?
The approach that we take most fundamentally when creating these lab-grown human organs is we take this kind of approach that we might not know all of the different things that are happening within a tissue. And so it should be from the get-go our mission to allow that tissue to self-assemble and to produce that complexity itself. In other words, like bottom-up engineering of these tissues will always lead to, as long as we see development, engagement of all those cellular pathways and like cellular logic that is employed every day in our own bodies, right? The growth of blood vessels, the alignment of certain cell types with each other, the functional signaling between those cell types to produce some function of a tissue. So to do that, we've merged a little bit the concepts of organs on chips, which are microfluidically bound, but typically engineered top down, right? We put a circular channel here beside this other circular channel, and we put one cell type in one and another in a second. We've merged that kind of principle with the principle of organoids, which is this bottom-up approach to make self-assembling tissues at huge scale. So hundreds of thousands of cells per tissue, centimeter size tissues each. And for looking at things like tissue-to-tissue interactions or even like complex interactions within one tissue that then go on and manifest in another, immune responses and things like that, it is a huge advantage to be able to link together these multiple systems, but to do so at an extremely high throughput. Again, like that is the really critical thing. If you do it once or you do it 10 times, that is a conceptually novel thing and be able to publish it and generate conceptual excitement. But to be able to actually use the tool really requires an infrastructure to be able to scale it. So yeah, we've seen things like, and we regularly like, test on things like having an adaptive immune response in a certain tissue due to immune toxicity, when an immune system makes a response against some drug that it's taking, or the innate immune system responding to bacteria as an example, coming from the bone marrow to some other tissue, like the lung, where it can fight off a lung infection, or things like the metabolism of a drug in a certain tissue, or the uptake of that drug in one tissue, and then its unavailability to perform its like therapeutic function in another. So being able to use these as Lego blocks and link and connect them becomes really profound.
Today, how many tissues can you all grow?
There's quite a lot. I would say the easier thing is to talk about the ones that we have not yet grown. So like within the library of these tissues, it covers the cardiovascular system, all the different scales of vasculature in the body, the pulmonary system from the conductive airways down to the alveolar sacs of gas transfer to the liver, intestine, bone marrow, large subset. The ones that are quite difficult is the brain, particularly in trying to work on very complex diseases that are linked tightly to cognition. So things like PTSD, let's say, as a condition that like definitely requires attention, but that is difficult for us to do without growing a full brain, maybe one day, right? And then the other thing that is tough for us are things that are like in intrinsically very large. So like a knee joint, for example, right? If we're looking to look at how knee replacements might work or might impact someone's gait, that is a tough thing just because the scale of it is far larger than even the centimeter-sized tissues that we cultivate.
I'm sure you've had to brush up on your human anatomy and physiology.
Yeah, that has been a huge benefit. You do it all.
That's great. So I want to maybe, switch gears a little bit. I'm curious, obviously, you probably want to work and partner with Big Pharma, right? How, from your perspective, what's their reaction been to sort of new types of tools like this? Are they receptive? Are they excited? Are they trying to see how does it fit into their current workflow? What's been your experience there?
Yeah, honestly, coming into this, my perspective was a little bit off. So I thought, from what you hear, pharmaceutical giants are huge and they move slowly and everything. And like to my surprise, there's a huge amount of interest in the pharmaceutical industry for not only gathering like data of this type and the scale, but also ideas on what to use it on. Like there are like immediate applications for whether it is early in discovery of new drugs or target identification and validation, all the way through to producing clinically supporting data in cases where there are some clinical trials where a certain patient population can't be pulled in phase one trials, but as an example, right? Yeah, it has been very exciting to be able to contribute to, I don't even know what to call it, like to contribute to the real stuff, right? Like to a clear thing and feel like we are able to make some impact in the world and not just be like working on technology development as I was afraid we might be, right? As a side effect of having to build all this technology first.
Yeah. What you do is so close to the clinic, so close to patients, right? These are candidates and drugs, right, that have been as vetted as possible through the R&D pipeline. And now the only goal is, hey, let's make sure it's safe and efficacious, right, in our target population.
Yeah. So like we're really close on one end, but on the other side, like the question that gets raised is like, what if we could just go right away from day zero to testing on human tissues when we are discovering new drugs? And even before we have the drug itself, like the molecule, what if we could understand like the underpinnings of physiology by having like actual complex substrates to test on? So if we start to modulate and like turn the dials on how different pathways are engaged in performing some function or how some receptors signal inflammation, like all of these different things that you then want to design a drug to do, we can tweak and play with at the very early discovery stage as well. And that's also an area where having access to huge amounts of data is very helpful.
Yeah. I always picture this operation to be expensive, right? In terms of cost, is it cost prohibitive or through automation and other techniques, have you been able to get the cost down of the materials, right? And the processes and reagents, et cetera, to something that's manageable?
Yeah, I would say there's two things that help us extremely strongly. The first is, I was saying earlier that the whole principle of lab on a chip is you don't have to make like 5 tons of something. You can make 5 milligrams of something because of the scale that allows you to work at. You can't shrink cells any smaller, so they can't go the way of the transistor. But thankfully, within the scope of the kind of microfluidic length scales we work at, having tissues that are centimeter sized or like half inch sized, it is quite large from the perspective of a single cell within that tissue. So in other words, the cell is under the full illusion that it is in the human body and has every reason to believe that it should act as such and be itself. And so the ability to not have to make artificial meat sized quantities of these substrates to answer these questions is a huge boon because cells are, they come with a cost. The other is that the scale and the process that we employ to grow these tissues from the get-go was designed to be scalable and was designed in such a way that we, like through scale-up, avoid the marginal costs of a sample prep where a bunch of solution is wasted or a cell extraction where 90% of those cells end up not being used. And so it is economies of scale being applied to these like complex human organ systems, both in their manufacture and in their kind of cultivation and testing and imaging and data collection through this automation pipeline that helps us.
So some miniaturization and the economies of scale, right, as a byproduct of that.
Yeah, like the scope of these platforms that we deploy here internally are about the footprint of a large lab bench, and a bit taller than I am. So it's like the large closet, a large wardrobe. And the output is about that of a kind of medium to large sized animal vivarium. Each one, and they cost many orders of magnitude lower to actually run. So like vivariums are among the most expensive buildings to own and operate. We have something that is tens of thousands of times more efficient in cost and scale and everything while producing human data.
Animals were harmed in the process, right?
Yeah, I think something I try not to make any, the topic of ethics, I think, is one that can easily seem like we're trying to use emotion to sell product. But I think it really is a case of putting your money where your mouth is, or at least putting your time where your mouth is, where it's, if we can do better than testing on animals, both from a scientific and an ethical perspective, then like we should go ahead and do it. And the ability to gather human data while also displacing like vast amounts of animal experimentation, I think allows us to do both, right? To have a social mission and an ethical mission, as well as having a scientific mission and being able to fulfill both in a pretty parallel way.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. All right, we'll just end with one question. What is your number one advice for future entrepreneurs who are listening in and thinking about, hey, I should I go right and embark down this founder journey?
I think the biggest and most useful thing for me has been this kind of conviction that doing something that is like aiming really big and thinking like, how can I push really hard against the trajectory of technology and in this case, biotech, the bigger the target, the more you will swing the needle with the same amount of pressure applied to that timeline. And when you talk about VCs and their investment theses, like they are looking for the fund returners. They're looking for the companies that will tackle such a big problem that they really make it big. And so in effect, in both being fulfilled by the work that you do, and in both having like easier access to really ambitious capital coming in, it is 100% worth your while to tackle the very difficult problems and to at least attempt it instead of trying to take a much smaller problem and say we have a higher chance of succeeding. Like it's, if you multiply chance of success with potential impact, it is usually the really big target that wins out on the calculations. Yeah, maybe to summarize, it's
Go big or go home, because I never thought about that way, but that's true. There's no founder, regardless of the technology, the product, how small incremental versus how big or disruptive it is. That was an easy journey. Like everything went my way. I was able to get capital. So you're absolutely right. It doesn't matter. It's almost irregardless, right, of the size of the problem that you're working against, except when you do look at the returns, right? It's completely outsized.
Yeah. If you're going to go through the effort, it helps to know that it'll be impactful in the end.
All right. That's such a great way to leave it. Thank you so much, Andre, for joining us. It was such a pleasure. Great conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Pleasure chatting.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.